Blog Talk Radio.
Carly? Well, I don't know what happened here. this is Carly's show, and we can't hear Carly. Carly? Can you hear me now, Carly?
Yes, I can hear.
Okay, well, we lost her. Okay, let's try again. We'll wait a minute here for Carly to come on. She will be broadcasting tonight. I don't know what the drag is to get the show up and running, but apparently we've got a problem. So she'll call in here in a minute. We're going to be talking about a lot of things tonight, and a lot of what we're going to be talking about is the here we go. Okay, Carly, can I get
hey,
you now?
Hey, Marty?
There you go.
Yes.
Go ahead, sweetie. Go ahead.
Okay, that was, sorry about that. I don't know what happened. I was going on
either.
And didn't realize you could not hear me.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So, all right, guys. Welcome to Hospice Survivors and Victims of Medical Kidnap, wherever you may be in this world this evening. I am your host, Carly Walden. I wanted to talk to preface, our guest will be on in about 10 minutes, and I wanted to preface, before he comes on, a few things that we have discussed in previous shows, and one of those is the Protected Medical Decisions document. You can obtain this document at www.patientsrightscouncil.org for a $15 donation. Also, author and speaker Lucy Karen Clay is providing consultations for this document for $44. That's if you need help. She is providing her assistance there. That's the first thing I want to talk about. Secondarily, we have spoke about how to revoke the hospice Medicare benefit. And it's simple as this, folks. You go to www.cgsmedicare.com. And what's going to come up is hospice discharge, comma, revocation, comma, and transfers. What you have to do, if you're in a hospice right now or in a palliative care program, all that you have to do to revoke this benefit is put in writing a signed statement that you are revoking the hospice benefit. And more than likely, that establishment is going to have revocation papers on hand as well. But if they don't, all you have to do is put it in writing and then get out of there. We had talked about that on previous shows. That's very critical for us as a society combating the culture of death and getting out of these places that are committing euthanasia. And a lot of people are not aware. That's what this show is about. We are screaming from the rooftops to make you aware that euthanasia is occurring in so many hospices and palliative care programs across the United States and in the world. And tonight we're going to be very blessed because we're going to be speaking with Alex Schadenberg, and he is from Ontario, Canada. He has a lot of experience, folks. He has been to a lot of conferences, and he speaks out. That's why tonight he's running a little bit late because he is doing the presentation, but he will be joining us shortly. He also manages Facebook Citizens Against Assisted Suicide. And this is so important, and I'm just going to share a personal bit really quick before I get him on. My maternal grandmother was hospitalized, and the first thing that came out of the hospitalist's mouth was hospice to me. And I said, no, she has a urinary tract infection, okay? We need to know and be educated that urinary tract infections can mimic dementia. They can hallucinate. They can see bugs. They can see an elephant. They can see, it's one of the most horrible things that can happen to the elderly is a urinary tract infection. So in hospitalists, you go in, they're going to immediately want to say, oh, hospice. They're going to look at their age, and they're going to want to put your loved one in a hospice. It comes up, I guarantee you, 99% of the time. So that's why we have to advocate and protect our families. Speaking from our own experience, I was able to save my grandmother's life because I saw the lethal drug cocktails that hospice uses, which is the comfort kit, which includes morphine, and that's Roxanol, I want you guys to know, is the most concentrated form of morphine. Ativan, Seroquel, or Haldol, and many other drugs that they have at their disposal, which when mixed together, begin to shut the body down. And they also starve and dehydrate them to death, which is a very, very painful death. So this idea, when you see on TV these commercials of hospice and palliative care, and we're here for your loved one and we care, and oh, it's all a facade. It's the biggest facade that America is facing today in the healthcare system. So,
Carly, your guest has joined you.
Okay, perfect. Welcome to the show, Alex.
I'm happy to be with you, Carly.
Thank you so much.
I just finished a presentation
to
a group of people, so.
I know you did, and I thank you so much for being able to join really quickly at the last minute after that presentation. Thank you. I'm going to introduce you now, Alex, to our audience. This is Alex Schadenberg, and he is from Ontario, Canada. He is the executive director at Euthanasia Prevention Coalitions, and he's the international director for groups working to stop assisted suicide, or international chair, excuse me. And with that introduction, I also wanted to mention a few things, Alex, that you manage on Facebook, Citizens Against Assisted Suicide, as well as the fact when you go to your website, and I believe I have that. Okay, when you go to www.ep, as in Peter, ccc.ca, he has
EPCC.ca.
Mm-hmm. You have a DVD called Fatal Flaws that can order, and also a documentary called The Euthanasia Deception that can be ordered from your website there. So with that introduction, welcome to the program, Peter, and I would like for you to introduce to our audience what it is that you speak about across this world.
Okay, so you introduced our videos, and that was very important. We created these videos, like The Euthanasia Deception, Fatal Flaws is actually going to be coming out in May, to counter the constant barrage of information that people see about, you know, why we should legalize euthanasia or assisted suicide. We're inundated, at least in Canada, we were inundated with stories about people going through difficult health conditions, and this was all supposedly to justify giving doctors the right to kill us by lethal injection. And in fact, in my own country, they legalized that. So we produced The Euthanasia Deception to tell the other story, the story of people whose lives have been taken by euthanasia, whose family members have now lived through this experience. Members who, like in the case of in The Euthanasia Deception, Hank Reitzma talks about his grandfather who never asked for euthanasia. All that happened was his grandmother had told the doctor she would like her husband to be kept comfortable. He wasn't even dying yet. He had an early stage cancer, but he was an elderly man. He certainly wasn't dying. And the doctor decided, oh, that must mean we're going to cause his death. So they caused his death. Nobody asked for it. No one said, oh, please, please kill us, even though, because that would be legal in the Netherlands. No. It was just done. And so we have to understand what this all means and how this affects us. But the other side of things is how this is being fed in our cultures by what's already going on in our hospital system. And let me give you an example.
Sure.
Recently, we've been dealing with a case in our own city of London, Ontario, of a of a woman who had a child who at 4 months old almost died from sudden infant death syndrome. So, you know, that's very sad. The child had stopped breathing, and she, though, had found the child before the child had actually not been breathing so long as to actually be fully dead. They were able to revive this child. The child had significant brain damage from that, so that's very sad.
Right.
But the hospital wanted the baby dead. So what the hospital did is they had the baby on the ventilator, and they said to the woman, well, you know, we'll do this for a couple of weeks. It gives you a chance to say goodbye to your child. You can hold your child. You can spend a bit of time. You can grieve. And then we're going to withdraw the ventilator, and your child will die. Well, they never told the woman that her baby had been breathing on its own. The baby was not ventilator dependent. They had the baby on the vent, but the respiratory technician had changed the settings because the baby wasn't breathing off the vent. The baby was breathing on its own, so there was just some oxygen assistance. But the hospital never told her that. What the hospital kept saying to her is, we have to make a decision soon, because then what we're going to do is we're going to withdraw the ventilator, even though the baby wasn't ventilator dependent. We're going to withdraw the ventilator, and you can hold this baby, and we'll give the baby enough morphine that it won't struggle in any way. And you can say goodbye, and we'll make sure we have counselors there to help you and everything, and we'll make it as humane and beautiful as possible. But the point was is this baby was breathing on its own. So what they were actually saying is, we're going to give your baby a lethal injection or enough drug that it's not going to be able to survive. We're going to withdraw it from the ventilator, knowing that it can breathe on its own, and your baby's going to die. But we won't tell you. We won't tell you.
Right.
And she found her to say
they don't give informed consent. They don't even give they don't give patients the even the chance to give informed consent that that's what they're doing. And to hear that this happened to a child is horrifying.
So, you know where they're coming from. This is a very eugenic attitude because here you have a child that does have brain damage. So there's no question about it. It's hard to know how well this child is going to develop. We don't know. And it doesn't matter really to me. And certainly to her mother who wants to take care of her, it doesn't matter. But to the hospital, it matters to them. They are quite convinced that this is a problem because you would have then this child being medically dependent possibly for the rest of its life. Now, what's very interesting, just to tell you more about this case and how things can be so deceptive in the hospitals, this isn't the only case. I'm using this case because it's recent and it's very egregious.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
But here you have a situation where the doctors, this is after the mother found out from the respiratory technician, because they didn't tell her, she just asked the technician, oh, how is my baby doing? And the technician said to her, oh, well, your baby's been breathing on its own for almost a week and a half now already. And that's how she found out. So it's sort of insane, because she was of the belief, because that's what she was told, that her baby was going to die, and which is a natural thing to think if you're being told this, right? So anyway, then they were going to do a test on this child to find out, well, really, how is this child really reacting, or how much this child's reacting? And it's hard to know with a baby who's had some brain damage, how much they're reacting. What the doctor did is he gave that child a significant amount of drug first so it couldn't react.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did the test.
Ugh.
Now, what happened is that we have a nurse that works with us, and she went in to visit, and she just happened. And the funny thing is often it's not noticeable on the chart, because they're more careful with the chart if they're doing something inappropriate. But what happened is she looked at the chart and she said to the mother, well, why did they give your baby this amount of drug before doing the test? It's not possible for your child to have reacted during the testing. How could she have reacted during the testing? And, of course, what they're trying to do is they were trying to prove to the mother, your child's not reacting at all. So really, you know, as sad as this is, maybe the best thing is just to give up. That's what they were trying to convince the mother. And the sad thing is when they're in a meeting and the mother pointed out, well, you gave my child this drug first before doing a test, what happened is that the doctor got so angry, he just blew up. But it was a bit of a turning point in the whole thing, because he knew he'd been caught. He knew he'd been caught.
He had
been caught, you know. And this was a bit of a turning point.
And they retaliate against families. I have spoke to many people for the past, you know, now I'm going on 4 years of being an advocate. And the doctors get very angry when they get caught. That's true. Mm-hmm.
Very,
Thanks
very
for pointing
angry.
That
anyway,
out, because
this
they
is just one story.
Family.
And this is more specific because it's a baby. But you know, there's lots of stories of people who are, let's say they have some level of dementia, and now they need a certain type of care, and let's say they have a bit of an infection. Well, then the pressure on the family is, well, let's not provide any antibiotics. Now, remember, antibiotics are not invasive. Let's say it was a different condition where there's an invasive procedure needing to be done, and now you're questioning whether that would be reasonable or not. Well, that's a good thing to maybe think about. But in the case of antibiotics, they're not invasive. This is not a situation where you're going to cause great stress to this person. Actually, not providing the antibiotics provides stress. But what then they say is, well, you know, maybe this is the great gift to your mother or your father, whoever. Often, you know, maybe this is the great gift because, you know, in fact, you know, if we don't provide antibiotics, they're going to die. Well, you know, this is the kind of thing, it's the denial. But the biggest thing that's the worst of all is the food and fluids question. And actually, just to be very clear to you, the food question is less an issue because as a human being, we take a long time to starve to death. It's dehydration that is really the question, because dehydration takes 10 to 14 days usually. And so it's what I refer to as slow euthanasia. And so someone who's not actually dying, but let's say they have a significant medical condition, but they're not actually dying. They're not actively dying. They have no medical condition, which is saying they're going to die anytime reasonably soon. So we're not talking about someone who's so close to death that it doesn't make sense to give them fluids. And then what they do is they say, well, you know, she's suffering so greatly. And, you know, sometimes someone does need some pain and symptom management, understandable. But what we'll do is we'll sedate them. We'll sedate them, they say, and then they withdraw the fluids and the food. Now, as I said, the food's really not the issue. It's the fluids that causes the slow euthanasia death, because it's the
they
die of dehydration.
Because I thought the food combined with, I'm learning from you, I thought that this combined with the dehydration was both a huge component, but really it's the dehydration. Okay,
it's the dehydration.
It's very painful.
Even a thin person can live a very long time without food. It's just the reality of how the body is made. In my current condition, I could probably live 60, 70 days without food. Not to say I'd be happy about it, but dehydration is 10 to 14 days. Now, often somebody who's in this condition will die a bit quicker because they might already be partially dehydrated anyway due to the type of care they might be receiving. And so it might only take 7 or 8 days because they already were partially dehydrated. So what they're doing then is they are giving somebody enough drug to sedate them, and then they dehydrate them to death, and then they say this is a loving, caring thing to do. And remember, I'm making it clear here. I'm talking with someone who's not physically otherwise dying. I'm not talking with the person who's so near to death that, you know, we just spend time with them and recognize that they're within a day or two of dying, and the thing that I'm should do then is just be with them. Food and fluids don't matter when I'm on my final day and my organs have shut down, and it doesn't matter then.
That's
it matters
correct.
When I'm actually going to live. That's right. So what they do is they're causing death by dehydration, and this has become a very common thing. And, you know, when you think about it, the more the culture allows this to happen, the more euthanasia and assisted suicide starts seeming like a compassionate death. You know, when they're debating euthanasia in Canada, a lot of people would say, well, if you think about how my mother died, and they'd be describing a death by dehydration, they'd be saying, you know, giving a lethal injection would be far more compassionate than that. And, of course, I have to be honest about it. Yeah, you're right. Giving a lethal injection is far more compassionate than death by dehydration. You're absolutely right. Neither one is right. Neither one is good. But if you're going to tell me the culture's gotten used to the one, then the other one is obviously seemingly something that is the better way to go.
Yeah, and I don't agree with either one.
Either one is absolutely wrong because it's killing people.
Yeah, it's murder. I mean, you're murdering
absolutely.
People. And they're taking, in my opinion, into their, you know, they're playing God. And that is very dangerous to do. And,
absolutely.
You know, you don't decide when someone's going to die. You don't do that. You don't start to dehydrate them. And then giving them the Roxanol, the Ativan, the Seroquel, you know, the Haldol, the all of these things that we think are compassionate, it's not. It's and I'm glad that you brought this up. It is murder. It's outright murder. And
so in the euthanasia,
you go ahead, please.
In the euthanasia deception, we feature a nurse who actually works with us now, who was involved in palliative care at a nursing home, a very large nursing home. And she had been doing this. And she came to an understanding of what she was doing. She didn't realize what she was doing. Now, you might say, how could you not realize? Well, she was trained by the system of palliative care. That, not to say that all palliative care is like this. Let's be honest. There is some palliative care that doesn't do this. They're very good about it. I know quite a few palliative care professionals who are supporters of our work who would never do this to people. They just don't. But the sad thing is that this modern palliative care has come to believe that this is a normal thing to do. So she was convinced that this was just a normal way to die. So she had been doing this to people, and she came aware about it. So you see that in the euthanasia deception, her confessing what she had been doing, and that she had been killing people, and she talks about how wrong it was. So you're thinking, are all these people, and this is the difficulty with this, are all these people, people who, like in the old Westerns, wore the black hat, so you can tell that, oh, that's the evil guy, and the one with the nice white hat, well, that's the good guy. Is it like that? And the sad reality is, well, no, it actually isn't like that. We have to recognize the problem of what's happened in our culture and be aware about it and help to protect people we know by recognizing, sadly, this is becoming somewhat commonplace, and therefore we have to be willing to say, no, we're not going to do that. You know, the question is mom actually dying? Is mom actually dying? Well, you know, in her condition, we're not sure how long she's going to live. So she might live quite a few months. She might live much longer. We really don't know. Well, then obviously speaking, we're not going to dehydrate this woman to death because guess what? She's not actually dying. Now, if she actually is experiencing, let's say her kidneys have shut down, and, you know, she's got the fluid retention problems, the body is shutting down, the breathing has become heavy, And they're saying, we really can't be putting fluid into your mother's body. We can't be. Well, you know, people call me about that, and they say, well, my mom, I've been told the organs are shut down, and this is what's going on. And what do I say to them? Stay
what?
With her. Don't go home.
Mm-hmm.
She is dying. It's okay. It's natural death. Spend that time with
right.
her. Tell her how much you love her and be with her. Because she
right.
is going to die in the next couple of days.
And that is so important for us to differentiate between, you know, natural death occurring and it, them hastening death. And it's that's why you know, stealth euthanasia, because they can mimic, it mimics a lot of the natural dying process when they start, when they begin the euthanasia process. You know, it mimics that. They try to, you know, it really does. And so people have a hard time, so that we call it stealth because it's happening right in front of your face. And many times family members do not know.
They have no idea
what's going on until after, you know, that person has passed, and then it all makes sense, or they got an autopsy. And let's say in a nice, good case that the medical examiner was truthful and actually put down what the cause of death was, not just what was listed when that person was enrolled in hospice or into a palliative care program. But yes, I just wanted to add that in there. Because people are
I think we have to be very concerned about people who experience head injuries or going through earlier stages of dementia, because dementia sometimes has a longer prognosis, because the culture and the medical system has devalued that person already. And I'll give you an example very quickly. And that's a couple years ago, I had lunch with a doctor who had written a few letters against euthanasia, and I knew of this doctor. She was a palliative care doctor, and I'd heard from so many people how wonderful she was. And so she was happy to meet me for lunch, and we were having lunch together, having a nice conversation. She's truly a wonderful woman in every way. And then we got into the question of course, as you're calling stealth euthanasia, I call it euthanasia by dehydration or slow euthanasia. And she got very upset at me, because at the hospital she worked at, they have a special ward for people who have had head injuries. And so she said to me, Alex, well, at our hospital, we treat all the people in the whole wider region who've had head injuries. They all get flown into our hospital. We've got a clinic there. We've got experts there deal with head injuries. But if they can't recover, this is how they die. They die by dehydration. If they, if they're not going to recover in any way, they are put into palliative care. They are sedated completely, and the fluids are withdrawn, and they die by dehydration. And she said to me, well, you know, Alex, what else are we going to do with them? There's nowhere else to put them. We have nowhere in our system to put them. They need total care. I said, we don't kill them. They are killing them. She says, we're not killing them. They can't. She says, they can't eat on their own. And I said, no, but they are not dying. They're not physically dying in any way, are they? Well, if they can't eat, and then she was arguing, but they couldn't physically eat on their own. You'd have to feed them, right? But, you know, let's think this one through further. When my babies were born, they couldn't eat on their own. Did we kill them? Well, no. When somebody has a major injury of some point, sometimes we have to feed them by a feeding tube.
Right.
And that's just how it is. It's not that it's not that it's ideal. It's just it works well. It provides them the life that they have, and it gives them an opportunity to recover somewhat. So let me give you then a further story about that. That same clinic, a few years ago, I had a nurse call me up, and she was all upset because the parents, this young man had a motorcycle accident, and it was quite a terrible motorcycle accident, but he seemed to be actually communicating. He seemed to be able to respond, right? But the parents had decided there was no hope for their son, and it might have been a hard decision for them. I don't know. I wasn't part of it. And they had decided that they would have him, you know, sedated completely and dehydrated to death. And what happened is that it was just before Christmas they had made that decision. So the nurses called me, and they're all upset. Like the one nurse who I knew called me. She's all upset about this. How could she be doing this to her? Da-da-da. She was really upset.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the comment, well, it's just before Christmas. Why don't you ask the family to take him home for Christmas?
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They took him home for Christmas.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And when they returned for Christmas, they decided they changed their mind. Because they actually were spending time with him, and they actually realized he was responding. When he's in a bed and their nurses are doing everything and you're visiting once in a while, remember this is a regional, this is a hospital that takes care of everyone in the region, so these people might have had to drive 2-3 hours, I don't know. I'm not sure how long they had to drive to go visit their son. They might have only seen him a few times, and they felt so terrible about this catastrophic accident.
Right.
And they had made that decision,
right.
But then they changed their mind. And so she calls me up after Christmas. She says, Alex, you would never believe it. They've changed their mind.
Oh.
I had nothing to do with it. Of course, I just made the suggestion once. She asked them to take him home for Christmas, meaning, well, if he's going to die, then maybe you want to have your last Christmas with him type idea. And they did that. They took him home.
That just gave me chills. I'm so happy.
I
love to hear these stories of overcoming, yes, and giving people a chance to survive. You know,
and not all of us are going to fully recover, but that's okay. It's okay. We're human beings. And how I care for the weakest among us, which is often in that person with a head injury, a person with early stage dementia or early stage, you know, issues as they get older, how I care for them, if I can truly love them, then that also affects how I treat others. And
that's
our cultures become very hard because we don't want to see people with great disabilities. We don't want to see people who have these great needs. We're uncomfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're so uncomfortable with it that the medical establishment has now solved the problem for us. We'll dehydrate
mm-hmm.
them to death. And that's very
mm-hmm.
sad.
It is very sad. And that's what this show is all about, Alex, is I'm having families come on that have had their, unfortunately, that have gone through this, and they have experienced their loved one was murdered by, you know, and this is a government-funded program in the United States. Medicare pays 100% of hospice. So,
yep.
Before you came on, I was talking about how they could revoke the hospice benefit, and I think that's very important. And, you know, because people don't realize that once they sign up for a hospice, that hospice doesn't come in and say, when they send out the salesperson, for example, they don't say, yes, we're going to be giving your loved one morphine, Ativan, and an antipsychotic drug, and we're not going to give them fluids, and we're not going to feed them. And this happened to our family, to me personally, to my grandmother.
Yep.
And
yep.
I figured out, thank God, really quickly that what they were doing, they were killing her. And it was only by police escort and getting a EMTs and getting her immediately hydrated and hooked up to IVs that her life was saved. She was literally within hours of dying because of what this hospice had done to her. And it was, like I said, it's murder. It's hastening death.
Yeah.
And that is not okay. And it's occurring.
That's right.
And people have got to get comfortable with having this conversation. You get back to comfort levels. People, when
I have one more story I want to tell you.
Oh, yes, please.
I got a phone call a few years ago from someone who I knew quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And she was calling me about this very issue. Her mother was terminally ill. There was no question about it. Her mother had cancer. She was terminally ill. And
mm-hmm.
they had been approached to have her put into hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say something about this first. The original hospice, and if you go back and you Google Dame Cicely Saunders and what she did at St. Christopher's in England,
mm-hmm.
was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it started. It was about truly journeying with people, making sure no one died alone, caring for people's physical, psychological, social, and spiritual needs as they were dying. That's what it was about.
Right.
Sadly, that is gone. in most places. I wish that existed everywhere because what she was doing was correct. Getting back to it. So she called me up and she was very uncomfortable with what the hospice was suggesting. And she said to me, and I knew this woman well enough that I knew that she had some very big issues with her mother too. She said to me, what am I going to do? I feel uncomfortable with what they're saying. And I said, you bring your mother home. You bring your mother home. And I told her, I guarantee you it's going to be one of the hardest things you're going to do in your life. But I also guarantee you it's going to be one of the most important things you do in your life. And it will affect you the rest of your life that you cared for your mother as she died. I said, bring her home. I said, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm in no way. I told her, like, this is not an easy thing I'm suggesting to you. She did that. After her mother died, she calls me up. She says, Alex, I did exactly as you said. And she says, you know, it's been the most wonderful gift you gave me because I did that. She says, it wasn't easy. There was nothing easy about it. And I'm not playing games. You and I know there's nothing. It's hard to care for someone.
No, there's not. I'm a caregiver myself.
But
I've been a caregiver going on 4 years. It's not easy at all, but it is one of the most beautiful things.
That's what she said. And she said, and it was also a healing experience for her because in her younger years, when she was a teenager, something very terrible had happened in their relationship. And I had heard about that. I'd heard her talks, right? I knew what she had talked about, what had happened to her. And so this was a healing experience, too, that allows you to have a closure. But, you know, we have to think about that, what it means to be human, right? What does it mean to be human?
Right.
And sometimes the greatest gifts, the things we do that bring us the most long-term satisfaction are sometimes the hardest things we can do in our life. And caring for someone who has total needs like that, that's hard. But that's what we need to do. I challenge people when someone says, well, what am I going to do? Well, it might not be easy, but bring them home. Bring them home.
Yes. Yes.
Care for them at home. If they're going to die anyway, it's not a situation where you're doing anything that's hurting them. What you're doing is you're trying to provide love and care for them. You're trying to provide a little bit of fluids for them so they are able to stay, have moisture enough that they're surviving those final days. Talk to them. Spend time with them. A lot of people have issues in their life. They have broken relationships. You would be surprised how much you heal when you love the person who you might even have a broken relationship with. As I'm telling you this, I got the next story. There's a woman I know from our church who was really a wonderful woman. She was one of the most wonderful people you would meet. You would say, holy camoli, where does this woman come from? She's always so nice. I used to always talk to her. She had had 10 kids. And her husband was an alcoholic, and he had left her when the when after having 10 kids, he had left her for another woman. And then he got cancer. He'd abandoned her. This woman, and I'm not saying people can do this easily, and I'm not saying that there's anybody other than this woman who might be able to do this. Her husband had left her. He had abandoned her. He was with another woman. Now he has cancer and he's dying, and the other woman didn't want anything to do with him. She took him and cared for him while he died. Now, you might think that's a crazy woman. But guess what? If you had met her, she's since passed away herself. If you had met her, you would say, that's the nicest woman I've ever met in my life. I cannot believe how wonderful a woman that is. And if you didn't even know the story, you would have said that about her. Because she was always so kind to everyone. She was. And this is maybe the challenge we face in our culture because we need to do these things.
Yes.
And we'd make a difference in the world if we can do these things.
Yes, we can. And speaking to what you just talked about, that's exactly what we did with my grandmother, is we brought her home. And, you know, she has been alive and well for we just had our 3-year anniversary on March the 9th of this year. And she's been alive.
Thing. You did the right thing.
Thank you.
Even if she had died, it would have been a natural death, at least, in a loving home.
Yes.
But she didn't. She survived.
Yes. And that's what our family decided. We said, no matter what, she's coming home, and we're going to do whatever it takes to take care of her. And I'm telling you, it has truly been one of the best things that ever happened to me. It was horrifying to find out what is actually going on, because I was going to school to be a doctor, Alex. And I stopped that and became an elder advocate. And and I'm very protective of my grandmother, I'm sure you can imagine. But we were able to find a pro-life doctor. A lot of people say, well, how do you find a pro-life doctor? Well, I do know that Human Life Alliance holds a database that they try to collect as many pro-life doctors in the database that identify as pro-life, so that they're not going to do that to that person and send them unnecessarily to what I call the invisible Holocaust. Or you can call it the elder cost, but as you mentioned, it's affecting all generations. I mean, it's happening to babies. That is very, very scary to me.
Because it's all being normalized now. They're normalizing it. It's becoming part of the medical system. And when I say that to you, that's why I told you the story about Christina, the nurse. She didn't realize that what she was doing was so horrific. She honestly thought that that's what you're supposed to do. But I tell you what, this doctor with the head injury issue, if you were to meet her, you'd say, well, what a wonderful woman. And on the outside, in every way she is, but she's been bought. The system has convinced her that this is what we do. And so it's so bad that it's co-opted so deep. It's so deep into the co-opting of people that many of them don't even realize that what they're doing is absolutely wrong, because it's killing people. And you cannot kill people. We can allow people to die. That's normal death. That's natural death. I have no problem with normal death, natural death. But killing is totally different than letting somebody die.
Yes. Yes,
and
it
as
is.
You can tell, when I was explaining these things, I was talking about those who are actually dying and those who are not dying. And I also made clear distinction between extraordinary treatment and normal care. And there's clear differences.
Yes.
You know, I recognize that certain times extraordinary treatment is just not, that's probably too much to do for someone in this condition, whereas normal care, out of love, I'm obligated to do normal care.
That's right. That's right. And I don't know, you know, it goes back to, you know, what I have been taught with the Belmont Report. And it is a lot of, you, like you said, it's secular, well, you know, secular bioethics, eugenics, that has infiltrated the healthcare system. And we must educate the public like we're doing right now and give them tools to fight, to protect, and to advocate for their loved ones. And protect that life, that sanctity of life. As you mentioned, the original founder of hospice, Cicely Dame Saunders, right? Correct? I remember studying about her. That is what we have to get back to. And there is pain management. You know, you can manage someone's pain. And for example, my grandmother was given 40 milligrams of Broxanol morphine in less than a two-day period. And they were combining it with Ativan and Seroquel and Haldol, and they were just killing her, outright killing her. And so people don't realize that when they sign those papers, it gives the hospice nurses, it's kind of like all-eat Chinese buffet, where they can administer as much medicine as they want. You know, they really can. And that's why hospice is not as regulated as the other, you know, as like nursing homes and hospitals. Even though they go in to nursing homes and hospitals, they can go anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, what has been the most effective technique that, and I know that you do presentations, I know that you have gone in the imposed death conferences and spoke. I'm a former board member of Hospice Patients Alliance, so I'm aware of that. And what has been your most effective technique in getting people to understand what's going on and let them know that they're not crazy, like they have gone through this,
okay,
that they're crazy or people call them crazy, but they're not.
I think what you're doing is the most effective way. People have to hear about it. And then what happens is that they might have their own experiences which are similar, and they might have felt uncomfortable with what had happened at that time, but they couldn't quite figure out what it was that it's not like there's a sign on the door of the hospice that says, "Well, we're the hospice that really tries to push you to die quickly, and the hospice mm-hmm. down the road, they're the ones who probably will care for you and allow you to live into a natural death." There's no sign on the door saying that there's a difference. And as I say,
right.
one doesn't
so
wear black hats and the other one doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
No, so you have
mm-hmm.
to be aware of what's going on, and then you have to recognize. You know, I get phone calls from people, and they'll say, "Well, you know, I got a call from a friend of mine when his dad was dying, and he said, Dad, you know, Alex, this is what they're saying and everything." And I said, "Harry, ask one question. If they put in the fluid, can your dad tolerate it? And what's happening is are the veins shutting down? What's going on? Is his respiratory system? Ask these basic questions." And he calls
mm-hmm.
me back and he says, "The doctor says, I can't even find a vein." I said, "Then spend some time with your dad, because I bet you he's going to be passing away in 48 hours. His dad died
uh-huh.
in less than 48 hours. It was a normal death. No one
mm-hmm.
caused his death. No one overloaded him. He died normally." But
mm-hmm.
we have in Canada, we've got a compassionate community care line. Now, this number actually works in the U.S. too. It's 1-855-675-8749. So it's 1-855-675-8749. And what that is that we offer advice to people. We try and help them through these situations, because most people who call have no idea how to react. And it's not because they're not smart or something. It's because they've got
right.
no experience with medicine. They've got no experience
right.
with these situations. A lot of them just have no idea how to react to these questions. They might feel uncomfortable with what the doctors or the nurses are saying, but they just don't know how to react to it. And so we try
right.
and help them through that. And sometimes
That's
all
wonderful.
That can happen is we provide an ability to listen to them, and we ask a lot of questions. And it's sort of difficult, but a lot of people have to talk it out. And they usually can find the right answer themselves just by talking it out. I say, "Well, you know, does your mother respond still? What's going on? Like, tell me more about this situation. Tell me how she is. How is she physically doing? Can you still talk to her? Is she drinking on her own? Can she still swallow?" All these type of questions.
Right.
Because if someone can still
right.
swallow fine, and they just may need a straw and you need some patience, maybe it's just that they are not getting, they like ginger ale, but no one's giving them ginger ale. Or maybe, no, whatever it is, I don't know. But if they can still swallow, then there's other things we can do, right? And we get
right.
down to these issues, then we talk about it. And some people call back over and over again because there's always another issue and another issue, but that's okay. Someone can talk to them about it. And by
right.
having this line, that's how this young woman called us in London to tell us, "Well, you know, I just found out that my baby's been breathing on its own, and they wouldn't even tell me that. What
oh
am I
God.
Supposed to do?" So
oh
what
God.
Ended up happening in her case is we did hire a lawyer to help her.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
That's what made a big difference.
And
in the end, it didn't cost much, because the lawyer we hired was the absolutely most well-known lawyer on these medical issues in Ontario. He was the
okay.
top lawyer. So we hired him, and she only had to mention his name. And they actually changed their minds pretty quick after that, because
uh-huh.
they knew that they were actually going to play a real ball game now. They
right.
actually have, she actually had a legal person who could win the case for her, and they
right.
changed her mind pretty quick.
Well,
and
that's
they started
wonderful.
Treating her differently.
We need to have that in the United States. It's very difficult for us, Alex, to get to hold, to be able to hold these facilities accountable after a hastened death has occurred, or euthanasia
Actually,
has
it's
occurred.
It's almost impossible after it's occurred.
It
That's
really
the sad
is.
The reality is, you know, it's almost impossible, because we don't, the problem is how you're going to prove it, and you're up against a medical team, I mean a legal team, which is well-funded, It's not only almost impossible. That's the sad reality. Once your loved ones are dead, it's nearly impossible to find justice.
Right.
And so when they talk about, oh, if we legalize assisted suicide, for instance, oh, we'll have safeguards, that's a bunch of bull. Sorry for my French. My French
no,
isn't very
you're
good.
Fine.
It's not true. It's not true. The system is designed that you almost have no ability to protect yourself in these situations once they've extended these things like this. It's nearly impossible because none of us have that kind of money to hire such a legal team to fight a hospital. We
right.
don't.
That's right. And we don't. And that's why a lot of people, they can't. That's why a lot of cases are not won. You're exactly right.
We have to make people aware before that time, before they actually die, that what's happening is wrong. As I say, if someone's actually dying, or if they're not quite nearing death, but they're on the trajectory, why can't they die a natural death? Why can't we just care for them? Maybe it takes an extra 2 or 3 weeks, but guess what? It's exactly how we're physically designed to be, and it's okay. And then you get closure. Mm-hmm. You have a fullness of what happened was the right way. And, you know, we start understanding more and more how I care for you is how you're going to end up caring for me.
That's right.
We recognize that we are in the human family together. And as much as I might wave the flag of individualism, I need you and you need me, and that's the reality. And if
you're
I ignore
so
your
right.
needs, then my needs also become ignored in the end. A hard
that's
society,
right.
which is what we're becoming, does not breed kindness. It does not
that's
breed
a
loving relationships with others. It breeds me before you, and that doesn't work. It doesn't
that's
work.
That's true. That's true.
And
it's very
we
hard
all become
to
vulnerable
see.
In our lives. Strong today, but that doesn't mean I'll be strong 10 years from now. We all become vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
We need each other. I need you and you need me. And I'm glad I've had this conversation with you.
Oh, me too. I mean, this is just a breath of fresh air because it is true. We do need one another and we do need to protect one another. And we,
absolutely.
You know, and by providing, you know, with your work, and there's so many advocates and activists that are trying their best to scream from the rooftops, this is what happened. Please listen to me. I'm providing that platform through this show.
So I have two final things to say. Because
I
do have to go. It's my son's birthday tonight, too. So I've got a few things to go.
Anyway, thank you
my
so
website
much.
Is epcc.ca. Epcc.ca. .ca, of course, means Canada. Then my blog. You can Google my blog or you can link to it from the website. My blog is the world's largest source of information on euthanasia and assisted suicide in the world. I've been maintaining this blog for a long time. It's got well over 3,000 articles, actually many, many more than 3,000 articles on these issues, all on this. And if you look at the right-hand side of the blog, all the topics are there. You can read about all these issues, the studies that have been done, everything. It's all there.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're wanting to find out more about these issues, it's all there. Go to the website. The Fatal Flaws film is coming out in May. It should be shown everywhere. And the Euthanasia Deception documentary came out in 2016. It should be shown everywhere. These are important videos because they uncover the truth. When you give the right of law to kill somebody, what happens? When I can lethally inject you or give you lethal drugs, as they do with assisted suicide, what happens? Well, people are affected by it. It's not about my choice and my autonomy. It's about abandoning people at the time of need. And vulnerable people, lives are lost. Lives are lost, and families are left in the lurch. You have to hear the stories, and then you realize, oh, well, maybe I fear suffering, and that could be true. Maybe I fear suffering. That could all be true.
Mm-hmm.
But killing is never the answer.
That's
killing
right.
is never the answer. Okay?
That's right, and I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Caring for
and,
somebody is
you know,
always
that,
what
I
want to
thank you so much for being
thank
on my
for
show.
Having me.
And I know you have to get going because it's your son's birthday. Is there any last words? Thank you so much for coming
no,
on.
No, I just think these programs are what's important. There's so much information that needs to be told to people. Maybe there's too much information. Maybe that's a problem, too. But I mean, we have to be aware that what was in the past has changed. Whether
yes.
I like it or not, the medical system and the attitudes towards ethics have changed.
Yes.
Not by everyone, but by many, and it's becoming so pervasive that, in fact,
mm-hmm.
yes, things are now occurring that should have never occurred, should not even be dreamed about, and now it's becoming
mm-hmm.
seen as normal. To dehydrate
mm-hmm.
to someone to death, sadly, is starting to be seen as normal. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's a terrible, terrible thing that we're experiencing, but we have to
yes,
be aware
it
of it before we can actually stand up to it.
Yes. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you.
I appreciate everything. And once again, you guys, like he's already mentioned, you can go. He has over 3,000 articles. And that's going to be coming out in May. That's Fatal Flaws. What date is that, Alex? May
what?
Well,
actually, we're having our premiere release on May 8th for it. So that's coming very soon, as I say. And we distribute it right across the world, actually. It will be available
okay.
both as a DVD, but it's also
okay.
going to be available as a downloadable, so people can go and buy it online and download it.
Okay, good.
It'll be available
okay,
both
perfect.
Ways.
Perfect.
The downloading,
so
of course, is not
website,
available
and we're gonna,
until, yeah.
But we can get the documentary, correct?
Absolutely.
With the
it's available in both forms right now. If you go to the website, you can actually link to under resources. You see the video, Euthanasia Deception. You can link on it. You can either download it or you can order it, and we'll send it to you.
Thank
if you,
you
download
so
it, I don't send
for,
it to you, obviously.
For... Right, exactly. So
thank you
so much for all your stories and your expertise on this. And we hope that many lives are saved after this tonight's show. So thank
well,
you
I hope
for
so.
Being on. Yeah,
thank
do
you
right now. Yes, and once again, I'll just say that your website is www.epcccca as Canada. Okay, and with that, I'm going to end the show tonight. Wherever you may be in this world, I hope that this is going to help save lives for you and your family. Thank you for tuning in. Good evening. Okay. Thank you, Alex.